What an anemic clap on my end.
Like a couple of ricotta noodles slapping together. It's okay. You didn't want to give away your position. I understand.
Right. If I'm too loud, they'll hear me.
It's so dumb, but that game occupies a significant portion of my mental capacity throughout the day.
Yeah, it's a real problem.
A real problem.
I mean, it's not a real problem, but it sometimes feels like one.
Maybe it was more last week that it was like that. I was just having to do some difficult things and some difficult work things, and I didn't want to do them. And so I was having a hard time making myself do them.
Yeah, I get that feeling. I find what's always really interesting to me about difficult work things is that every single time I actually get stuck into one, I become obsessed with it, right? And then it's like, I gotta get this out. I gotta do it. And I can't stop until it's done. Mm-hmm. But it's just the start. It's always just the starting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like pushing yourself over the little peak to get yourself into the work. So like once you're into the work, it's good. It's getting the momentum going is the hard part. And that's what I was kind of struggling with. I think what compounded it was I've done what I'm doing or what I did 3 times. This is the 4th time now, which was the shipping stuff for DK. But I wasn't redoing it to make it different. I was just pouring.
This is just a port, right?
Yeah, but it's still different, you know, because a large portion of the DK Rails app uses callbacks, active record model callbacks, and I was figuring out what's the best way to not use callbacks because number one, Phoenix doesn't have those callbacks, but number two, if I'm rethinking it. Or if I'm redoing it, what would be an easier way or a less magical way to handle this? Because right now in the Rails app, when any part of an order changes, there are several callbacks that run into section and update totals and things like that. And I didn't want that to always be happening because in the past, there have been a couple of times where I didn't remember all the places where those were happening. And so I've accidentally triggered like infinite loops inside of Rails. And then I'd have to remember, okay, where are all the callbacks? How is this happening? And I just didn't want to spread out that much. So I was trying to figure out how I could isolate things more, be more declarative about it, and still kind of have that nice feature where when you change an order, you get all like the tax updates itself, the shipping numbers update themselves, and all that stuff happens. And so I figured it out, and the answer was just using more change sets for Ecto. And it worked out pretty well. But like you said, getting the momentum to want to do it again for the 4th time was kind of hard.
Yeah, especially with something like that where you're dealing, it's a part of the code that's touching money and dealing with user accounts and things getting sent to people and all that. Like you think about all the tests you got to write and mm-hmm. just how much of a big deal it is if something goes wrong with this part of the app. It's really tough.
Yeah. It can be pretty tough. And another reason why I didn't want to use a bunch of callbacks because I want to have better control over that system. Maybe that was the biggest reason was because I wanted to feel like I had better control of it. Like anytime an order changed, I don't think the whole thing needs to go through and update everything. I just needed to be smarter about it, right? So
sure.
With Ecto, you have these concept of changes. And I guess it's similar to like an active model or active record model change where you change a record and then there's a hash with changes in it, right?
So similar to like the dirty stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So Ecto just has the change set struct, and when you change the struct, it keeps track of what has changed. So if you change a name on something, for example, that changes, the change set struct will have a map with changes in it, and that map will contain a name, and it works kind of similar, I guess, in my mind. So really what I'm doing is I'm just making specific change sets, right? So I guess the classic example, if you're thinking about users and accounts, is you might have a user change set where the normal change set would be like the user changing their email address and their name and maybe their location. And then you have a separate change set called like a password change set. And that password change set might hook into like bcrypt or something, right? To encrypt a password. And you wouldn't necessarily want to do that, or you wouldn't necessarily have to do that every time a user updates their profile, right? You would only want to do that anytime they're changing a password or registering. So you would essentially just have 2 separate functions there, one's for updating public information and one's for updating the password. So in my case, I have like a cart change set, and I have just a regular order change set. And the cart change set is what has all the logic for actually updating all the totals and changing all that stuff. And the order change set would be something simple like assigning it to a user or something that's not quite as intensive as running all these other calculations.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it only the calculations exist there, and also the validation of what can be changed, or did I mishear that?
No, that's right. Okay. So a different change set could each different change set function can have different validations. So you can validate data in different contexts, which has also been really helpful, right? And that's one thing where I ran into problems with Rails in the past, because I didn't have or didn't know of a super clean way off the top of my head to have case specific validations in Rails without making like a PoRO class and then pulling in active model validation. And that was one way I did it in Rails, but this is a little bit cleaner, I think, because now you're not having to have a separate module or a class for each context you want to validate in. You just have a different function.
Yeah, I mean that sounds really nice, actually. I tell you, every single time you talk about this Elixir stuff, I'm just jealous. I just want to switch everything over.
Yeah,
just want to switch everything over. What's the testing? What's testing like?
I like it. So I know for a fact that you like mini test. So the testing system with Elixir is called XUnit. And for Phoenix, it just uses XUnit. It doesn't use anything special. So I think the coolest thing about Phoenix, to take a step back, is that in the Elixir ecosystem, you have these idea of Mix apps. And so Mix is a package manager. It's also like a task runner and all that stuff. So you would do Mix new, and that would be like just a straight Elixir application. And it just so happens when you do Phoenix new, it makes a Mix project and then adds the Phoenix stuff into a couple of folders, really. So that being said, testing a Phoenix application is not that much different than testing a regular, plain old vanilla Elixir application.
And is XUnit comparable to Minitest, or is it what? Okay.
Yeah, XUnit, I would compare XUnit to Minitest. I like it a lot. It's really small and simple. You just have your regular assertions. And I guess what makes XUnit really cool is not even XUnit itself, it's just Elixir's language features, like pattern matching, for example. So typically in Minitest, you might assert that something. So like say you're testing a class and you have an instance of that class and you want to test different attributes on that instance. You might do like assert class dot some value equals, like double equals what you expect, right?
Yeah.
And that's fine. But with Elixir, you can also do pattern matching. So you could do assert some function call or some struct equals single equals, and then you actually build out what you expect to be included there. And it will check for all the values. It'll make sure that every value inside coincides with what you're expecting in the pattern match, which has been pretty nice.
Yeah, pattern matching is definitely one of those things that you show me these code snippets in, and for sure, that is so nice and so in line with how I think about a lot of things. I feel like it just seems like a great way to get that. But it's awesome to hear that the testing is just really straightforward as well. Because I mean, that's something that's become so important to me. We were talking a little bit about this the other day, and man, it's just, I don't even remember how I did backend development, at least before TDD, like that. Just the idea that I was shipping stuff that had no tests or very, very minimal tests. And then new features would just go in because the client wanted them that day or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back on that, that is terrifying. That is terrifying. I am a convert, I gotta say.
Yeah. Maybe it might have been, and this may be a poor excuse for that, but maybe it was because we are primarily building MVPs. So it was easier to keep the state of the application in one's head at the same, like at once, you know? I don't know how you deal with Verify Investor. That would have been nuts to me, but
yeah,
that's the only thing I can think of was that number one, we didn't have huge timelines. We had relatively short timelines or incredibly short times, really.
Well, yeah. I mean, a lot of times we were talking four to maybe 6 weeks to build out an app from getting handed the designs to launching.
Right. Right. And that's including like feedback loops and testing, like the client tests it for the first time, like, oh, we got to change all the things. But that's
consulting's such an interesting, oh man, consulting.
Yeah, it's difficult. But that's the only thing I can come up with, because I was thinking about that. And when that was the only thing I came up with was that the apps were MVP status, so they weren't too crazy yet.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about the level of features that we were shipping in those versus what we're shipping now. I mean, even just a few years ago, like DK, I know for a fact is massively more complicated than anything else that you've done. And same with NestNodes for me. It's just like, it's an order of magnitude, certainly. More features, just more complexity, more stuff happening. And now, knowing what I know now, having these scars, I imagine going back to just not having tests for every single new thing, and it freaks me out, man.
Yeah, there was one of those things where I challenged myself. There was a point in time where I didn't ever think I was going to get the hang of it. You know, I just didn't think I would ever feel comfortable.
Yep.
And I always talked about that post-it note that I had where I was just hanging off of my iMac. And so I looked at that, and every time I looked at it, I would just start writing tests before. Like, if I didn't have test what I was doing, I would start writing tests for it. And that helped. And slowly, it just kind of became a thing. And I think what also helped me was that when I transitioned over to DK, and I had started writing a lot of tests before that, but really when I transitioned over to DK, my timelines were what I said they were. My timelines didn't depend on somebody else. So it was a lot easier to kind of relax. But also, I feel really lucky that my boss, when I tell her that testing is important, she's like, yeah, it is 100%. I totally get it. Understand it. Let's make sure we have time for it. And that really helped me out. And I know for a fact the thing wouldn't even be working if I hadn't had tests for it, because of all the changes that I've been having, like making changes, going back and changing things, doing the shipping three times. I've caught so many bugs, just small things, in just running the tests.
Yeah, absolutely. Even like regressions, totally. I catch regressions fairly often, but basically every time I sit down to write new tests, I catch some kind of bug. Even if it's a pretty edge casey weird thing that probably would never happen, I will probably catch something if I'm writing tests for half hour, an hour, or whatever.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It really does make a big difference in the quality of the code you're shipping. And the thing is, like you were saying, there's kind of just a point where when you sit down to write a new feature, you're just like, okay, I'm going to write out the test for this. And it feels totally natural and great and actually not any slower.
Yeah. So, I mean, like a lot of people, before they start working on stuff, they will kind of write it out anyway. You know, they'll have like a markdown document. They'll have some place that they're writing stuff down. So why not just open a new test file and write a bunch of pending tests? Turn those notes into pending tests, because that's what I do a lot. I've shown you screenshots where I have a module full of pending tests, and they're just like describing what I want to happen. And I'm not making the tests work. I'm not actually writing the bodies of the tests. I'm just writing pending tests that notify myself, hey, this is what I think should happen. And a lot of times I'll use those in place of to-dos as well, because when I run all my tests, it tells me how many pending tests I have or how many tests were skipped and all that. And in fact, actually,
do you have that blocking your CI if you have pending tests?
I was just about to say that. So depending on what I'm trying to do, I can add, so XUnit has a thing called tags, and so you can tag different tests with different tags. And so I have a tag called skip. And if I need to move quickly, and I know if the test that I'm making pending is more of like a to-do item, then I'll tag it with skip. I suppose I could make a to-do tag as well, but I just haven't. And so when it skips it, it won't actually, obviously it won't run the test, which means that the test doesn't fail. Because I have it set up where that any pending tests that run report back as a failed test.
Sure. Yeah. I haven't quite gotten that far yet, but I really want to. It's so nice to be able to just go in and say, those tags sound lovely, by the way. I'm assuming you can just run different tests by tag as well.
Correct.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. Yeah. man, I just want to switch every little thing you say about it.
Right. So a big use case for the tags for me was when I was doing the number one, the shipping stuff, or actually number two, the shipping stuff, but number one, the Stripe stuff, because I always had mixed feelings of like running something like VCR that captures the output of an API and caches it for later. And because then you have to like expire those tapes and you have to replay them and recapture the responses. And Stripe kind of is okay. They expect that their test environment is going to get hit with requests. You know, they don't have like any sort of like crazy rate limit on it and stuff like that. And so obviously I don't want to run those tests that hit Stripe's API and hit the external APIs every time. So what I did was I tagged them with external. And then when I want to specifically run those, I can run those tests. But if not, they won't get run every single time the test suite runs.
But I'm assuming those are forced to run on your CI?
They will be once I have a CI set up for Elixir.
Ah, sure, sure.
Which I should probably do that sooner than later. I mean, I had it running, but then I was using Semaphore, which was pretty good. It was fast, super fast. Granted, my Elixir tests run orders of magnitude faster than my Rails test suite. We're talking like 30 seconds as compared to 3 minutes for roughly the same number of tests.
That's rough.
Yeah. Yeah. Semaphore works pretty well. I mean, so 30 seconds, including those live API requests. So that's including Easy Post-it and Stripe Hit for several tests.
That's amazing, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't have any external requests in NestNotes right now. And it takes about like 35 seconds to run.
Yeah. It's a big thing. Like, so I was using a thing called mixtest.watch. And so in the Rails world, I was always using guard, which runs, like when you save a file, it's going to run the tests for that corresponding file only. And so I'm using the thing called mixtest.watch. And whenever I save any file, it runs all of my tests. And what's crazy is that running all of my tests typically takes about as long as the guard would take to run only tests for a certain file.
That's painful, man.
Yeah.
What an amazing change.
Yeah, I mean, that's the biggest quality of life improvement, really, you know, because a lot of people talk about, or I've seen a lot of people talk about, like, oh, how long CIs take and how long the test suite takes to run. I've heard of like test suites taking like 20 minutes to run, which blows my mind.
Oh, yeah, that's totally a thing. That's not even like an uncommon thing, is the really mind blowing part to me. Like,
right.
So many larger software projects have these test suites that actually do take 20 minutes, 30 minutes, even longer.
Yeah,
to run, and that's just a thing that people have to live with.
Yeah, it's wild. And so, I mean, I assume, obviously, the more tests I write, the longer it's going to take, but I think I have a long ways to get before I hit. So I added this tool called Wallaby. There's several different ones for Elixir, but Wallaby you could think of it as like Capybara for Rails. It's just a way to use a headless browser to test the actual DOM of your app. And so I added some Wallaby tests for it, and it didn't really add much time onto my test suite at all, just a few seconds, which I was pretty happy about. And another cool thing about XUnit and Elixir tests in general is that you can run them async. So you can have all your tests run asynchronously, which obviously would increase the test time or decrease the amount of time it takes to run the tests by quite a bit.
That's super cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's been my saving grace for all this stuff, is just writing tests. And trying to stick to the basic things. So a few days ago, I think it was. So anyway, like Phoenix 1.3 came out, and then there's like this talk of context, which I've mentioned before. And one of the things that I've noticed about contexts is that they can get really big. And so I had a context from a marketplace, which was really just a module with a bunch of functions that were used for getting and setting data on stores and product sales and products and stuff like that. My context ended up becoming around, I think it was like 600-700 lines. And that's not wild, you know, but it's a lot.
It's more than you want in one file.
It's more than I want. And it's more tests than I want for one file. And so what I ended up doing was I took that one module. I'm just going to start calling them modules, because that's what they are. Context makes it seem like a special thing, but really a context is just a module full of functions for working with a specific part of your API. And so I split that one module up into like six, right? And yeah, my surface area grew, but the tests became so much clearer and so much easier to understand in just looking at them. The logic was so much easier to look at, you know, scrolling and searching became a lot easier. It just was nice, you know? So I'm sticking to the basics, you know, modules and functions. And it's working out really well. And it just so happens that when I split things out into small modules full of functions, testing those becomes so much easier.
Yeah, that's for sure a thing. I've noticed that kind of in both directions. Like if I'm doing more TDD style work, my end result often tends to be more like functionally pure, I guess, even in Ruby, for whatever that's worth. Like, but like less side effects, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
But it just kind of forces you into writing more organized code, because more organized code is easier to test.
It really is.
Turns out, right?
And the side effect thing is big too, because I'm thinking through like, okay, how do I want to organize this app? And that was a big, that's a big thing for me in that rail, like my Rails app. Granted, this is just how I built it. So I'm sure there are much nicer ways to organize things. Trailblazer comes to mind. That's one way, but, in my Rails app, there were just several folders that had just a dump truck full of classes in them. And there wasn't much context around them unless you were to go through and read the source of every file. Whereas I feel like in my Elixir app, there's way more folders and it's deeper horizontally, but it's much more shallow vertically, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I really like the idea that it's shallow vertically. And one thing that's been helping me a lot is I'm making sure that every time I make a new module, I write module documentation for it. And I describe the why, not the how, like not how this thing works, but why it's here in the first place. And that's been hugely beneficial because, again, when I'm writing my code, I can hover over a module name in VS Code or whatever. It'll work with Atom and Sublime, whatever. It'll pop up the documentation I wrote. So because I wrote the why it's here, all I do in any source file is hover over the module name. And then I figure out why it's named like that and why it's there and why it's being used. It's been super beneficial for me.
I should rewrite those notes.
The bug.
You got me, man.
It's hard. Like it's like really in reality, it's hard to justify, but in like when you're thinking of small things like that, small things that could lead to bigger payoffs, that's how I convinced myself in the first place to redo DK. And that's how I convinced my boss to let me do redo DK.
That's exactly, I've been thinking about that so, so much lately. It's funny that you bring that up. The idea of those little changes that might seem insignificant taken on their own, but then they all add up. And this is just a straight rip of John Syracuse's awesome article on the perceptual cliff from several years ago. Five years ago now? That's crazy. But just the idea that in technology, and I think this is true in programming as well as in consumer electronics, but the idea that you've got these little improvements. Oh, the new MacBook is 5% thinner and 10% lighter and has 5% better battery life or whatever that thing is. And people are like, oh, well, it's not a big deal. And it might actually not be, but so much of technology is these little things all stacking up and adding up over months and years to create a totally new device category. Mm-hmm. I mean, and this is sort of what we saw with the evolution of the smartphone, for example, or, I mean, even look at laptops from 10 years ago. It doesn't even look like what we consider a modern laptop to be today, like a MacBook. It's a completely different device almost, and it's just from those little tiny changes. I think that's very much the same for programming. Like any one of these things in Elixir taken alone is cool maybe, but like not enough to convince somebody to rewrite their app.
Right.
But all together, it really becomes pretty compelling. I'm not gonna do it, but it's pretty compelling, Sean.
I'll get a message from you at like 2 a.m. tonight, and.
No, don't you curse me to that.
No, it's great. Like it's, I mean, I'm sure, I think a lot of my qualms with Rails came about because Rails was my first big framework. And so I just didn't have that much experience when I learned it. And so I learned a lot of bad habits and I knew about a lot of those bad habits going into Phoenix. And so I told myself, hey, I'm going to get rid of some of these. But also I think because of like, you might look at Elixir and be like, oh, that probably is similar to Ruby because it looks similar, but they're nothing alike. And the approach that you take in building applications is really nothing alike either. And I think that also really helps me, especially. So I read, I think it was in a forum. I can try to look it up, but actually, no, I was talking to Chris McCord, the legend himself, the guy that originally created Phoenix. And we were just talking and I was talking about some Rails things that I was trying to get out of my brain. And he made mention that a lot of the Rails community, especially when you're learning, they kind of teach you or they plant this idea in your head that queries are bad and the database is your bottleneck. And that's not necessarily true. So a lot of Rails apps have these giant like God class tables, right? Just tables with a ton of columns in them. And a lot of Rails apps, I think, especially where people have worked on them and then they say like, oh, the database is what's causing this to be slow. Active Record is what's causing this to be slow. It's a lot. There's like a lot of N plus ones happening and it's just not optimized at all. And
that's really easy to do in Rails as well. Like it doesn't encourage splitting stuff up, certainly in its architecture.
Right. Right, exactly. And it's not always the case. Like, Knight Foundation is running a Rails app and they're serving hundreds of thousands of requests and it's fine. It's, you know, it's not using, it's like using 150 megabytes of RAM for that number of requests. It's fine, you know, but I had that idea in my head. The database is slow. Queries are slow. More queries are bad. Especially, that was the biggest one. More queries are bad. And so I was talking to him and he kind of like made me realize that because I 100% had those ideas in my head. And that was because of that. That's what I read. That's what people told me in different Slacks and stuff. So chop it all down and make, you know, make it one query, make it as slim as possible. And so coming into Phoenix, there's a lot more. So, I mean, Ecto forces you to preload. So Ecto just won't preload unless you specifically tell it to. So for example, if you have a user and user has many posts and you render out a user struct, the value, the default value for the posts object or map that comes back is actually a struct called Ecto association not loaded.
Okay, sure.
So it'll actually make you preload that first, which in turn gets rid of your N plus ones. So there's some stuff there that they've done to kind of eliminate some of that. But that was a really big struggle for me. Was
a higher level thing, right? Where they instead of, or maybe a lower level thing, it's closer to the metal. The framework itself is preventing you from making that bad choice that might otherwise seem like the obvious path.
Yes, exactly.
And that's really powerful. And that's the sort of convention that I can really get into personally.
Here's a real life example. So when I first inherited DK, there were N plus ones all over the place. And a lot of the serializers were rendering nested collections. So like a user might render, a store might render products, which in turn might render the store, which in turn might render the products, which is bad, 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 obviously. And that would just happen by default. Rails would happily spit that out. Like, you asked me to do it, here you go. And Elixir's like, or Ecto is like, nope, not preloading that, or I'm not loading that in unless you specifically tell me to preload it. And that's very small. Like, that's a, it was a big difference for me to get used to, but in that small change in my workflow, it obviously would have eliminated a problem. So getting originally when DK Rails was launched, it used like a gig and a half of memory, which is just an ungodly amount of memory for the amount of traffic that we had.
For a website that's a store and has very few visitors
just,
at the time.
Just insane, right?
And just so launched.
The majority of the work from getting that to like a gig and a half to 500 megabytes was fixing the serializers. That wouldn't have been a problem, period, in if I were to use Phoenix out of the go, because you can't do that. So anyhow, yeah, like you said, it's just like these little things that add up. And I've said it to my boss many times, the Elixir version of this app is just plain better. And the big reason for that is now I have more experience, like hindsight 2020, right? I have that at hindsight experience from working on the first version. But also it's all those little things like we're talking about now. A lot of these little Ecto things that we get for free, things that other people have learned the hard way and kind of built into these tools for us that I'm leveraging to make a better product.
All right, Sean. So we should probably talk about this. It's episode 100. 100 episodes. We've been doing this for 2 years now, which kind of seems crazy.
Yeah.
I don't like, so much has changed and so much is the same.
Yeah.
But here we are. It's been 100 episodes.
A lot has changed. Not even, I'm trying to think what's the same. Like, not really anything that I can.
I still really like Vue. When we started the podcast is right when I was starting to dig into Vue. And I'm like, this seems really interesting and cool.
Yeah.
And I still think it's pretty interesting and pretty cool. I'm a that big like, fan.
That was like my claim to fame, right? That was the one thing I've showed you in life that you liked, besides Elixir.
It's a good find. It's a good find.
Yeah.
I'm so very thankful that Vue is a thing.
Yeah, me too.
People should go give Evan and all them money on Patreon.
If you've made money using Vue, you should give a little bit back, because it's definitely deserved.
It doesn't have to be anything crazy, but like they really do deserve it. They are doing a bang up job.
They really are. Yeah. And it's just getting bigger and bigger and better. It's crazy. Yep. I'm trying to think what else. I mean,
I still have really loud dogs.
Yeah. I'm just thankful that people stuck around, you know?
Yeah, it's really cool. We've got some people. I've definitely made some friends for this podcast, which I think makes it a win.
Yeah, it makes it worth it. I've learned a lot talking. I'm thankful for the people that have messaged me and said, you said something wrong, or this didn't actually make sense, or, you know, cause I've learned from it. But yeah, I've made some friends. I've met some people that I look up to and some people that I've learned a lot from. And yeah, I'm really thankful for the community. I'm thankful for the people that have stuck around. I feel like this is a farewell speech. It's not.
Yeah, we're not going anywhere. We are taking a month break. So this is going to be the last episode for like, I think four weeks or 3 weeks. Basically we're going to be gone for October and then back first week in November, I think right now.
Ooh.
But basically we talked about a little bit, and like, it's been 100 episodes and we want to make sure that we're like, continuing to evolve the show in a way that we're happy with and something that we can be proud of going forward and still make sure that it's cool and that we like making it every week.
Yeah. I think, not to be selfish, but that's the biggest thing for me is, do I still enjoy it?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I want to fool around with the format a little bit. I want to try, maybe we'll try doing some streaming. We've talked about that a few times. And just having that little bit of time to kind of formulate things, I think will be really good.
Maybe we could do some PUBG stream records where we're talking, we're doing the podcast. Mm. We can just go and hide in the school for a while.
I don't know that we'd end up talking a whole lot about tech.
No.
Probably not.
Probably not.
Oh, a huge thank you to Sarah, who has edited all of our episodes and helped us out with everything every week for 2 years. That's been super cool. She's awesome. And we very much appreciate her help.
She's the real hero.
She makes all of spec run.
She does. Yeah, she does. She really does. She helps me find my car in San Francisco and get back to their place because I would have gotten lost. Oh man. No, but really, yeah. Thanks to Sarah. She's doing a great job. She's been doing a great job. We're definitely spoiled to have her around and helping us out. So.
All right. Well, I don't have my bell. I want to hit my bell to close off this episode, but I'm in my childhood bedroom. So I can't. It's weird, man. Been recording here a lot lately.
Yeah. You have been, actually. But you never would have thought that you'd be recording a podcast down the road.
They didn't exist. We didn't even have podcasts when I was growing up. We had to walk uphill two ways in the snow to get our podcasts.
You had to walk to the grocery store or the barbershop, I guess, to listen to the people gossip.
Sorry, there's a bit of a dog freak out going on.
That's fine.
There's three of them, man. Three dogs.
Dog fighting.
They're just excited about something.
They're excited about life.